Psalm 60. To the choir master, according to Shushan Enduth, a miktam of David, for instruction when he strove with Aram Naharim and with Aram Zobah, and when Joab on his return struck down 12,000 of Edom in the valley of Salt. O God, you have rejected us, broken our defenses. You have been angry, O restore us. You have made the land to quake. You have torn it open. Repair its breaches, for it totters. You have made your people see hard things. You have given us wine to drink that made us stagger. You have set up a banner for those who fear you, that they may flee to it from the bow, Selah. That your beloved ones may be delivered, give salvation by your right hand and answer us. God has spoken in his holiness. With exultation, I will divide up Shechem and the portion, the vale of Succoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim is my helmet, Judah is my scepter, Moab is my wash basin. Upon Edom I cast my shoe. Over Philistia I shout in triumph. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go forth, O God, with our armies. O grant us help against the foe, for vain is the salvation of man. With God we shall do valiantly. It is he who tread down our foes. Are you an optimist or are you a pessimist? Pessimist. That may be an unfair question. Maybe you say to myself, maybe your answer is I'm neither. Well, sometimes we classify ourselves as either optimistic people or pessimistic people. And I ask that question because as we live in this world, we need to have the proper perspective. That's what I want you to think about. There's a new term, not a new term, but a term that's been used a lot now, and that's dystopian, right? Over the last number of years or such, you see more type of dystopian things on media now. One of the most famous is the Man in the High Castle. The series. It was a series that's very, very interesting. And the idea of the series is, what if the Axis powers won World War II? What would life be like? Had a dystopian future. And, you know, we seem in our world maybe more. There have always been dystopian stories. But maybe there are more dystopian stories in our modern times than have been in the past. And it probably reflects the fact that optimism. See, optimism is utopia. And pessimism is dystopia. Dystopia is basically imagine a world or society where people are led to live fearful, wretched, and inhuman lives at times, that where evil wins. You see, if you want to classify culture and philosophy, the modernity that was had was utopian. We're going to create good worlds as technology increases and such. We're going to make things better. Well, we live in a postmodern world. And that's why you're seeing more dystopian things, because postmodern believe things are not necessarily going to get better, things are going to get worse. But dystopian and utopian are always exist in this world. What about Christians? What about Christianity? Should we be dystopian or utopian? Should we be pessimist or optimist? Well, that's a false dichotomy in this world. I mean, should we live this world like Proverbs? We always get blessed for what we do. Should we be more, oh, we're going to bring in the kingdom as we grow things, we're going to make everything great. Not going to be the Germans who take over the world under Hitler, it's going to be the church. That's a utopian view of this world. Or should we be dystopian, like maybe dispensationalist? The world's going to hell in a handbasket. We just want to get off the boat. We're waiting for the rapture. Dystopian. Neither of those options are valid for us. And I think this psalm will help us see that. Let's look at Psalm 60 with this idea of how we should, and how it will tell us how we can deal with these difficulties in the world. Let's look at Psalm 60. By the way, do you notice that the introduction to it, the superscription of is the longest one of the Psalms? Longest. It's interesting. That's just a point to be noticed. But this psalm, Psalm 60, is it a pessimistic psalm about David's current situation, or is it an optimistic psalm? It's a lament. A lament is pessimistic. Things aren't going well. He's asking God to change the course of things. Now, if you look at the superscription, this is tied to what is going on, maybe other chapters, but primarily what's going on in 2 Samuel 8. I'm going to turn to, if you want, you can turn with me to 2 Samuel 8. This is, according to what we have as that superscription on, this is really the situation that it's in what's going on historically in 2 Samuel 8 that caused David to pen the psalm. Second Samuel 8. The ESV puts a heading for 2 Samuel 8 is David's victories. And if you read the account, it's a summary of all David's victories against all these, how he defeated Hadazar, the son of Rabbah. It means all the kings and all the people that he defeated. And then at the end of it, he speaks about his epistle. The way it's described is victory, optimistic. And that's why when you read Psalm 60, which seems pessimistic, you wonder what's going on. And a lot of commentators have different views. But I think the simple view is this. David did win all the victories. But there were battles. There were battles. And when you have a battles, sometimes things get really bad. Think about the movies you watch where the good guys win. If you're going to write a good story about a movie or a book, let's say The Lord of the Rings, you heighten the calamity that's happened and how it looks like the enemy's going to win. And then all of a sudden, victory. We have it in Westerns, right? You know, you're fighting against them, and all of a sudden the cavalry comes over the hill. You hear the trumpet. Often that's what way it works in this world. We're going to have battles and winning and losing. What David is saying here in the psalm is that during many of these battles, you can focus here on Edom. When we have these battles, Israel had battles, it had losses. It felt that, the idea that we're being defeated. But notice what he does here in this psalm. He ties their ineffectiveness. He ties the victory of the enemy in these skirmishes to Israel's sin and disobedience to God. We would all argue that God is sovereign in all things. He is sovereign in all things. But Israel had a certain type of relationship with God. And it goes back to the covenant he made at Sinai. And the particular relationship he had with Israel, he didn't have this with other nations, though he was sovereign over them. The particular relation he had with Israel was, if you obey me, if you do the right thing, if you look to me, I will give you victory over your enemies, and I will give you the land, and I will bless you. If you disobey me, you will run from your enemies. We cannot take that and apply that to ourselves as if we are Israel in the psalm. We'll see why we can't do that. I'm not saying that our sins have consequences, but we in the church don't have that same relationship, covenant relationship with God that Israel as a nation had. Notice I'm speaking about Israel as a nation. I'm not talking about David. I'm not talking about those within Israel. But as a covenant nation, they had a certain relationship. And we can't ascribe it to us in the church. We cannot even ascribe it. We definitely can't ascribe it to our nation politically. But David here, as we look at Psalm 60, says, O God, you have rejected us and broken our defenses. The only reason why God would reject Israel is what? Israel rejected God. That was a special relationship. Those who were never in relationship with God don't reject God. But Israel was in some way related to God and by covenant. You have been angry, O restore us. Now, this idea of restore us is interesting as we look at things. It's interesting because this idea of restore us, some translations have this idea of turn to us. And there's a what's going on? Is there being a restore us to the situation or turn? It's a verb that I think the proper translation, because of the stem of the Hebrew, is restore us. But I think the King James and other translations have turned to us, because in the call, the simple, it is a return. And I think what it means is this: is because God, because we have angered God, because we have been and somehow disobedient, David doesn't say it here, because of that, God has turned in anger to them. And they're falling. And what he's asking is for God to turn away from his anger and turn to them with blessing, that they would be restored to him and to blessing. I think this, we see a similar thing going on in Psalm 44. Listen to what he says in Psalm 44, verse 9. But you have rejected us and disgraced us and have not gone out with our armies. I think that fits, that's right. But listen to what he says in verse 23 of Psalm 44. Awake! Why are you sleeping? O Lord, rouse yourself and do not reject us forever. You see, that's what he's asking here, is you. I want you to turn to us so that we would be restored in that relationship and in victory. That's what David's asking. Remember, this is during those battles of Psalm, of 1 Samuel chapter 8. So what he's saying, by the way, if you're taking notes, we can see verses 1 through 5 as David's complaint with confidence. David's complaint with confidence. The complaint is, we're losing. Our defenses have broken because God is angry at us. And the situation, he describes the way they feel in battle. He describes it this way: "You have made the land to quake. You have torn it open. Repair the breaches, for it totters." Now, what he's doing in poetic language is describing the situation they're experiencing. There's probably not a real earthquake. That's not the problem. The enemy is winning and we're losing. He's describing this language, the situation in the midst of that battle. "You have made your people to see hard things," his losses. "You have given us wine to drink and made us stagger." This is the way he feels in the midst of the battle. They seem to be losing, and he's describing it in this psalm. This is David's complaint. But he speaks of the complaint with confidence. You see the confidence? We see it in verse 2. Actually, verse 1, the end of verse 1, "Turn to us or restore us." Right? The reason why the enemies are winning is God's mad at us, but I got to go to the God who's mad at us. We're going to see why he does that. But he's complaining with confidence. He says something interesting in verse 4. "You have set up a banner for those who fear you." Now, it's interesting. The banner is like a flag, and we can see in battle. The word banner, this Hebrew word, is used a number of times in Scripture, not a whole lot, maybe from five to ten times. I don't have the exact count. But it can mean a couple of things. Typically, it can mean a flag or a banner like with an army, where it's a rallying point. Some people think that this psalm, because in the middle of it, it's a rallying point for those who are retreating. And those who fear God, even though we're losing the battle, those who fear God need to turn to this banner, to a rallying point, so that we can regroup. Or it could be a rallying banner to follow and to win. But it's the same idea. Just it's what direction you're going to at that moment. Listen to what it says in Psalm 4, verse 6. "Raise a standard toward Zion. Flee for safety. Stay not, for I bring disaster from the north, land of great destruction." That word standard is the same word banner. So let's translate it. "Raise a banner toward Zion. Flee for safety. Stay not." You see, that's the idea. And Psalm 46, God is speaking about the judgment he's going to bring on Judah by Babylon. And what he's saying is, "I'm going to provide safety for some of you. Flee to it." And that, if that's possible in our section. I don't think that's what's going on in Psalm 60. Because in Psalm 60, David is not asking for a few people to escape an inevitable judgment. David's asking for a victory for all of Israel. I think he's speaking about the banner to rally behind for victory. That's what he's calling for. What he's saying, and he's calling, he said, God has raised the banner. Well, how has he set up the banner? What is the banner that he has set up? Again, it's not a real cloth banner that David has. He's talking about the one that God has set up. He says in verse 5 that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer us. I think that's describing the banner. You see, notice in verses 1 through 5, it's complaint and hope. And we see that in verse 1, the end of verse 1, the hope is that God would turn from what seems to be his anger because of their disobedience. And the banner and verse 5 in confidence begins to describe what causes him to do that. Notice, it's the banner that God has set up that he will use to turn the table on Israel's enemies. And we know that he did in Psalm from 2 Samuel 8. David did win ultimate victory. Well, verses 6 through 8 really describe the banner. It really describes the banner. And you know what it is? It's the promise of God. It's the promise of God. Look what he says here. God has spoken in his holiness. Again, another translation note. I think the NIV translates that God has spoken from his sanctuary. I think it's holiness is a more literal translation. I think what the NIV, you know, is a paraphrase, right? It's a paraphrase translation. And I think what it says is they're saying God has spoken from the place of his holiness, which is his holy sanctuary. But I think it's correctly in most of our translations that say it, that God has spoken from his holiness. And here's a connection. This helps us to see what the banner is. Turn, if you will, to Psalm 89, verse 35. Because David says the same thing in this psalm. In verse 35, we read, "Once for all I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David." Now what? Now it says sworn from my holiness. Our psalm says in his holiness. It's translated the same Hebrew conjunction, which is a bet. What do you translate from or in? It's the same construction. And I think it's the linkage. Here David, in our psalm, is reminded what he speaks of in Psalm 89. Here's David in battle. Here's David giving defeat. But he says God's going to turn because it's this promise from his holiness. And what is the promise according to Psalm 35? He will not lie to David. David may lie. David may even commit adultery. He may even murder. But God's not going to lie to David. By the way, how many of you know the next line? He will not lie to David. Did you look at verse 36? His offspring shall endure forever. His throne as long as the sun before me. Psalm 89 is speaking about the covenant that God promised where? In 2 Samuel 7 before the victories of 2 Samuel 8. That's the banner is the Davidic covenant, the Davidic promise that God has set up. That's where David has his hope. Though the world, though in the battle, it may be dystopian, he knows that God's going to give ultimate victory. But his hope is not in what he sees necessarily. His hope is not in man. His hope is not even in his own army. God and his promise. That's where his hope is. And look what it describes. You see, this is the banner. God's promise. Verse 6, God has spoken in his holiness. With exaltation, I will drive up Shechem, divide up Shechem, the portion out of the vale or valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim is my helmet, Judah is my scepter, Moab my washbasin. Upon Edom I cast my shoe, over Philistia I shout in triumph. Well, what was God's promise? God's promise was both land, his sovereign control over the land, and the people. God's promise to his people is not only a land, but a people to populate the land. And so he speaks of Shechem. Shechem is north of Jerusalem, near the mountains of Ebal and Gazim. Succoth is east of the Jordan. The valley of Succoth is east of the Jordan. Mostly speaking about the land and the area of the land that God promised Israel, and actually that David even conquered. So he speaks there of the land. Then he speaks of Gilead as well, that land, and Manasseh, the land of Manasseh, and the people of Manasseh. Ephraim, now, not only the land, but now the people. Interesting, this is the people that David, before the divided kingdom, he uses them. And Judah as his scepter, thinking of David and his promise. Moab, now he speaks about outside the kingdom. Moab is my wash basin. You see, it's going to go beyond. I'm going to destroy it. It's mine too. Upon Edom I cast my shoe. These are the ones that David's fighting. And God says, I'm going to give you victory. This is the promise. Over Philistia, I shout in triumph. God promises victory. And then David asks a question. See, what we have in verses 1 through 5 is David's complaint with confidence in his God, the promise. And in verse 6 and 8, we have the promise of God, which is the basis of David's confidence. And then David turns back to complaint. He turns back to complaint in verse 9, but it's complaint in light of the promise. Complaint in light of the promise. He asks a question. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Now here's a question. What's the city? What's the city he's speaking about here? Well, most exegetes understand the context of 2 Samuel 8. There's a certain city Edom, the certain city of Edom, and it's called Petra. Petra is it's a city that you gotta go through mountains, a steep canyon to get to. It's an easily defensible city. Because it's only a small thing, so it's easy to defend. And you can actually even go to that area and see how even hiking to it's difficult. I think that's the city David has in mind. Who will bring me to this fortified city? You see, it will be a city that David will come, not only to attack, but to rule over. And we see that Joab comes back. We saw that and even mentioned this thing, that God uses Joab to help to defeat that city. Who will lead me to Edom? You see, it's a question for David. He's not sure. Why? Because he says the complaint. He repeats the complaint that he said in verse 1, have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go forth with armies. Oh God. Notice in verse 10, oh God, repeated twice to speak of the intensity of his anguish. He says, have you not rejected us, oh God? And then, will you not go forth, oh God, with our armies? He has that promise. He spoke of the promise, which he always had, but he reminds himself of the promise in verse 6 and 8, and so he will say in verse 11, oh, grant us help against our foe. For vain is the salvation of man. Now, I've talked to you about the use of the genitive, various uses I've mentioned about in a lot of translation languages, and in Greek we speak of the objective genitive or the subjective genitive. You find that in a lot of language. Well, I think let's look at English. When it says the salvation of man, an objective genitive would be the object. The object of the salvation would be man. Or the subjective genitive, the salvation of that man brings. Man is the subject of this, brings the salvation. Here he's not talking about the objective. Because man is savable. If it isn't, we wouldn't be here. It's a subjective genitive. What David is saying is man cannot bring the salvation. I can't bring the salvation. My armies can't bring the salvation. That goes against this psalm. For vain is the salvation of man, verse 12, with God we shall do valiantly. God will bring salvation. What is he saying here? Again, David is saying the same thing here that he said to Goliath. 1 Samuel 17, verse 46 and 47. This is the day the Lord delivered you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all his assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand today. That's what David is saying. It's God's, in his current situation, in the situation he's speaking about the defeat, he just needs to trust God. He has to have confidence in God's promise that God's going to bring it safely in. And he is going to do it. See, David is a man who ultimately is a king who ultimately trusted God. He did trust God. He really did. He didn't rely mostly on himself. At times he faltered. He remembered when he did a census of Israel. The reason why that God brought judgment was that almost was I'm trusting in my. That's why Joab said, "Don't do it." He may be trusting this human thing. Then of course he quickly repented, and God relieved him because of the promise. But David is a paradigm in the kings for all of his sons. He's a paradigm of one who trusted God, and we see that in the psalm. He turned to God ultimately. It is he who will tread down our foes. David knew that as a young man. He knew that through his entire life. And God promised that God promised he would have a son of David who would be like David, but I think even better than David. And you read the history of the kings of Israel, right? Many of them did not trust. We think of the time of Jeremiah when God did finally bring judgment upon Israel the king, who'd they trust in? Well, they trusted in the Babylonians when the Assyrians were coming. They trusted in the Egyptians. And what did Jeremiah say? Don't trust in them. Don't go to Egypt. Egypt can't help you. Only God can help you. But they refused. Israel didn't have a king that would trust in him. In the midst of the anguish, imagine having your city surrounded by Babylonians and a prophet saying to you, just trust God. But the Egyptians have a great army. That would be foolishness, but that's what they should have done. But those kings didn't do it because they waited the king who would trust in the promise. David trusted in the promise. Many of his sons did not trust in the promise. None of them to the extent of David. But then Jesus comes. The son of David that 1 Samuel 7 speaks about. And he had a dystopian life, didn't he? Did he have victory? Who was winning? through Jesus' pilgrimage on this earth. Who was winning when he was on the cross? He trusted in God's promise. And see, the promise, that God made to Jesus was a promise he made in eternity past. It's the agreement between the Father and the Son. We call it the covenant of redemption, or the pactum salutis. And Jesus speaks about it. Behold, Israel, me the girl, I have come to do your will. Jesus agreed. It was an agreement. He would come and do God's will. He would obey, and then God would reward him. But that obedience meant to take this dystopian life, to die on the cross, so that utopia would come in the right way. And he didn't trust. Jesus ultimately trusted. Jesus, the man, trusted that God would raise him up. He submitted himself. And then came victory. It's interesting. I took it out. I had a hymn that we done earlier, and it was a great line. But think about it. We're going to sing a song at the end. I'm going to explain, but as I was preparing the sermon, I was thinking of another hymn. Talk about the banner. See, the banner's the promise. Well, what's the promise? Jesus had a promise, and the promise for him was, you obey me, I'll reward you. That was a promise to Jesus. And the reward would include all those that God had chosen in him before the foundation of the world. That was also part of that eternal covenant. But we have a promise. And unlike Israel, our promise is not if we're obedient, God will reward us. Jesus takes care of that part. We're part of the reward. Remember land and people? Land and people, we're the people. The land is heaven and earth, the new heaven, not this one. Lift high the cross, the love of Christ proclaimed, till all the world adore his sacred name. Lift high the cross, that's the banner. It goes on to say this in the first and one of the stanza. Led on their way by his triumphant sign, that's the cross, the hosts of God in conquering ranks combine. Right now we're conquering through what we suffer. You see, we can rejoice in our suffering because it's not the end. We look to the promise. This idea of utopia. We're not bringing in utopia in this world. Jesus is. We inherit it. The hymn we're going to end in is a great one. How firm the foundation. The foundation is not us, it's Jesus. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say than to you he has said? To you who for refuge to Jesus have fled. You see the banner? Remember I said the banner can be negative and positive? We turn to him for refuge. He's the banner. It's his cross. But it's also the thing that we use to march on. Paul captures that for us in 2 Corinthians. I'm going to read chapter 4, verses 8 through 11, and we'll close with this as an application for this idea. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Christ, life of Jesus, also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. Let's go to him in prayer.